From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on Monday when the jury in the Harvey Weinstein trial finally reached a verdict. After working for days through a deadlock, the jury delivered their decision as Weinstein sat motionless in the courtroom. Weinstein, of course, was one of the most powerful figures in movie making and entertainment. He was accused of sexual misconduct of various forms by 96 women on the record, and there are well over 100 allegations of misconduct. The trial focused on several of those allegations. In the end, the jury convicted Weinstein of felony sex crime and rape. They acquitted him of the most serious charges, predatory sexual assault. But the convictions are significant. Weinstein could spend up to 29 years in prison. And when the verdict was read, the New York Times reports that Weinstein seemed stunned. "But I'm innocent," he repeatedly told his attorney. Powerful men are not accustomed to being held to account for their crimes, and Weinstein's attorney promised to fight on for him. But for the moment, this conviction stands as a massive victory for Weinstein's victims. For example, the Italian actress and director Asia Argento, one of the early accusers who went on the record, wrote on Instagram, quote, "Harvey Weinstein is now a convicted rapist. Two survivors cry and celebrate. Thank you, God," end quote. Deborah Turkheimer, a law professor at Northwestern, told the Times, quote, "It's a perfect test case of what happens when a culture begins to shift," end quote. Weinstein's attorney says this is the moment that the Me Too movement has gone too far. So let's explore the impact of the Weinstein verdict. My guests this hour include Megan DeChateauvieux, CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center. Megan, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
And Lauren Berger's here. Lauren is a sexual assault service, Restore Sexual Assault Service training coordinator, the training coordinator for Restore, who's been here a number of times. And thanks for making the time to come back and talk about this.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Let me ask both of you your reactions when these verdicts finally hit. I say finally because this was obviously a very well-watched and observed trial, and there were days in which the judge was instructing the jury to work this out in some way to get the deadlock broken. We've got two convictions and then two charges where there were acquittals, but again, 5 to 29 years in prison is a sentence here. What did you think, Megan?
I felt an overwhelming sense of relief. And I think it seems like it's been going on a lot longer than even just the trial. It seems like I've been hearing about this for a long time. And to have it come to this conclusion was just really validating, empowering. It felt like at this point, finally, women's voices and survivors' voices are being heard and listened to by this jury. So I was surprised to see how long it took for deliberations. But I did feel an overwhelming sense of relief.
Lauren, what did you think?
Similarly to when we have cases that are resolved on a more local level, there's sort of a myriad feelings. There's relief at the closure of sort of the process. There is a sense of justice for some, you know, that there's finally accountability for somebody who for a long time thought that they could, you know, assault people with impunity. And there's still some that feel that there's more to be done and sort of maybe not enough justice, or that they don't feel justice was done. And that can be different for different people depending on, you know, what justice looks like for them. Sometimes people want to see very punitive measures and they feel that, you know, no punitive punishment is essentially going to be good enough. And there are others who are looking for maybe, you know, financial compensation for pain or losses that they've suffered in other ways. Others turn to kind of other forms of justice outside the criminal justice system. But in this case, it really did feel relieving to have kind of this piece of the process completed, and to know that, I think it was Tom Hanks, as I was listening to some of the news timelines as kind of preparing for this before I came in, he was the one that told the BBC that Harvey Weinstein captured a moment in time for there was a before and an after in terms of our understanding of this issue and how we kind of process when these things happen, not only for the people that are directly involved, but what they mean for our own lives and people we know.
I want to ask you, Lauren, and frankly, I want to ask both of you, though, if you view this as this one-off case, a high-profile singular case, or if this does represent something different, as Deborah Turkheimer, the law professor at Northwestern, told the Times, a test case of what happens not just to one person or with one set of allegations, but when an entire culture begins to shift. Lauren, yes or no?
I think in many ways we can say yes, because we're in a time now where many people have the chance to weigh in and how they're impacted by this via social media and talking to other people in ways that people can produce content in ways they couldn't in the past decades. And Harvey Weinstein's case, for both the proximity that a lot of people felt because they were celebrities, and for various reasons people feel connected to different celebrities through affinities of certain kinds, and because he came to light and sort of all these different instances came to light when hashtag MeToo was really capturing a consciousness on its own. And because his trial has had this sort of lifespan in this couple of years of this nuanced of understanding where we can have these conversations on social media or through mediums like this, there's been a sort of evolution in how we understand accountability and what it means to protect certain things over others, and a real, certainly maybe on an individual level, a referendum on what it means to have had the culture we've been in for so long. And we see different laws shifting in that regard, as far as harassment and workplaces and different policies, different litigation options being opened up for survivors. So in some ways, I think there's really direct implications that this is more than just an isolated case.
Well, and sort of building on this point, you know, as Lauren mentioned, Weinstein was the first, and you rarely see when a culture, if a culture is shifting, I guess culture is already always sort of shifting and evolving, but if it's going in sort of a pronounced change in direction, you rarely have it sort of demarcated in a singular moment, whereas we do in the Me Too era. It goes back to October 2017, the publication of the stories in The New Yorker and The New York Times, allegations against Harvey Weinstein. So now it's Weinstein himself's trial, and it feels like this moment is a cultural shift. But my guess is the people who work with victims will be able to define whether the shift is truly happening if victims feel like they're going to be heard and more willing to come forward as a result of cases like this. Do you think that's happening?
I think that that's exactly one of the implications when we talk about the shift in culture from this one instance. And certainly in Restore's work, both in just having a social media presence, and many of us staff members individually have that presence as well on our own, and because of the shifts in activity that we've seen on our hotline over the course of the Me Too movement, there really have been punctuation marks throughout that. And I think that that's really helped a lot of people synthesize what happened to them in a context of power and control and power-based violence, and help them not only feel able to articulate what happened to them as not okay and as crossing their boundaries, but that there is somebody to talk to about that. There's even a space for this conversation and where to turn to for that, because prior to this moment, for various reasons, there was still a huge misunderstanding about what exactly sexual violence is.
Megan, do you see the culture shifting in this way, or do you view this as more of a one-off?
I've been reflecting on the trial itself and kind of unpacking some of what happened and thinking about the victim-blaming statements that were made by the defense. And I think that that is all too common in cases like this, and locally as well. We do see that, where the victim will go on the stand and share their story and be, you know, interrogated about their experience and have to relive that trauma and the re-traumatization of that retelling of their story. And so I think for a lot of survivors who were tuned into this particular trial and watching that same old tired defense and seeing that it came back, that no, we're not listening to that anymore, that doesn't hold up in court, that doesn't matter what you were wearing, it doesn't matter what you were doing, it doesn't matter who you are or where you stand in the power dynamics of this situation, your voice matters and that you are believed. And so that, I think, is a huge moment for survivors who might be hesitant to speak up in court and feel that they won't be validated or believed in that setting. So I hear a lot of the feedback being that this is just a beginning. This is just the beginning of a drop in a watershed movement, just a drop in the wave of justice, is one of the expressions I read that I really loved. And I think that's true. I think that it is a watershed moment, that we will be seeing a lot more women coming forward, a lot more survivors of all genders coming forward and knowing that their stories will be believed, that they will be heard and listened to, and then there will be some kind of justice found for what they've brought forward. I also would like to think that it's also an ending. This is the end of something. This is the end of an era when it was okay to behave in these ways, when you weren't called to account for your actions, when people in powerful positions can prey on people in less powerful positions in all sorts of ways, and that was somehow accepted, and the silence of victims was the norm. And so now breaking that silence with the Me Too and with the full voice of so many survivors behind it, I think we're definitely in a culture shift right now.
Well, listeners, if you want to join the conversation, and I know it can be a sensitive one, there's multiple ways to do it. If you want to call, you can do that. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org, as we talk about the impact of the Harvey Weinstein trial and the verdicts and the convictions that are going to put him in prison for up to 29 years. Now, you mentioned the defense attorney and the defense's tactics here. And I want to listen to some sound that we have of Donna Rotunno. Now, a little bit of background first here. Donna Rotunno was the lead defense attorney for Harvey Weinstein. He shuffled the deck in terms of who was representing him and shifted to having Ms. Rotunno in charge. Here's what she said after the verdict to the New York Times, quote, "It's absolutely horrible for me to watch my client taken into custody. Harvey Weinstein is very strong. He took it like a man. He knows this is not over," end quote. I have a problem with the statement, "took it like a man," which we can return to in just a moment. But she argued in court that the accusers had willingly had sex with Harvey Weinstein to further their own careers. And only years later, after he had been accused by others, they began to think of their encounters with him as non-consensual. She says, "Having voluntary sex with someone, even if it is a begrudging act, is not a crime after the fact," end quote. Is that what you mean by victim blaming, or is it something else?
Yeah, the idea that somehow by what you're wearing or what you're doing or how you behave, that you're, the quote, asking for it, unquote, that there's a set up where particular women, by doing particular things, are putting themselves in a situation that they somehow deserved, that is the victim blaming, to say that I didn't get myself out of this. I put myself into this situation. I am somehow responsible for this. I am at fault, when it is never the survivor's fault.
Lauren?
I think it's a little unfair for the defense counsel to position the idea of willingness and begrudgingness in terms of exchanging a sexual act for, and they're saying in that statement that they're exchanging sexual acts for advancements in their career. There's someone who has power over someone else in terms of, "I can advance your career, I can do XYZ for you," and the idea of someone using sexual contact as a bargaining chip in that way is not seen on its face as a power imbalance and therefore power-based violence, because if somebody is maybe not contemporaneously able to articulate the ways in which that transgresses their boundaries, it's not fair to say that because they were able to understand that years later and say just how hurt they were by that experience, that they now get to not have their voice heard.
Let me ask you just to respond to that final statement she made, and let's take it in isolation. Not at all saying it applies to this case, but in general, her statement is the following. Quote, "Having voluntary sex with someone, even if it is a begrudging act, is not a crime after the fact," end quote. Lauren?
I think, again, that's an unfair characterization of consent. And when we talk about consent, and this is, again, the notable culture change, I think, that we've noticed in the last couple of years, because one can say consent is the presence of yes or the absence of no. And those two things ended up being pretty, there's a lot of middle ground, pretty distant from one another. And so when somebody is going to be held accountable for not saying no loudly enough, there's really, that might have been kind of the mantra when we began this journey or before hashtag Me Too. And really we've come to refocus our efforts toward the idea that there needs to be a presence of yes, and there needs to be a mutual understanding that we each have equal opportunity to say whether or not we're actually interested in this kind of sexual contact. And the fact that there exists now an exchange of a career advancement, a movie opportunity, so to speak, in this case, that in and of itself presents the power differential, that means there isn't necessarily anything like, I want to do this, but I low-key regret it. It's, I want to do this, or I don't. And if somebody says, I don't want to, but I feel that I have to in my career, we now no longer define that as consensual.
Okay, Megan?
And consent is such a good thing for everyone. It's about healthy relationships. It's liberating for all genders, and it removes this sort of puritanical guessing game around intimacy. That the idea that, you know, as Evan was sharing, that the word sex is a bad word for seven-year-olds, as your son brought home earlier, that is not the case. We should be talking to our kids about this. We should be talking to young people about what consent looks like and what these terms are, because it's to shroud intimacy in shame and secrecy is not going to benefit anyone. And so to have these honest conversations as equals, as strong partners, as people to say, you know, do we have consent in this situation is liberating for all. There's this stereotype that I hear so often about men, and you kind of alluded to it with the attorney's comment too, that he took it like a man. But this idea that men are predators in some way, or have to be strong in these very toxic masculinity ways, and they have needs they can't help if they see a woman in a cotton nightgown, it's obscene and so degrading to men to have that idea of their sexuality. And I think that this consent era, this era of Me Too, is bringing a lot of that to light as well. So not only empowering women's voices, but allowing men to be fully present in these relationships in different ways.
Yeah, the idea that she would say he took it like a man has its own problems on its face, I mm-hmm. think. But here's what I want to listen to. So Donna Rotunno, the lead defense attorney for Harvey Weinstein, in the midst of the trial, did an extended interview with Megan Toohey, an investigative reporter for The New York Times and the co-author of She Said, Breaking the Sexual Harassment Story That Helped Ignite a Movement. So Toohey is talking to Donna Rotunno for The Daily, which is the New York Times daily podcast. They talk for about 25 minutes, and they're basically done. And then at the end, Megan Toohey is sort of wrapping up, and she's thinking, is there anything I missed? And she basically plays the raw tape here, so you can hear the full exchange, in which it starts like this.
I had another question, which was whether or not you've been sexually assaulted.
I have not.
Okay.
I have not. Because I would never put myself in that position.
So you're saying, okay, actually, I'm sorry. So you're saying that you have never been sexually assaulted because you would never put yourself in the position of being sexually assaulted?
No, I've always made choices from college age on where I never drank too much. I never went home with someone that I didn't know. I just never put myself in any vulnerable circumstance, ever.
Do you believe that every woman who's been sexually assaulted somehow put herself in that position, whether it was having drinks or agreeing to go to a hotel room?
Absolutely not. But just as we make smart decisions when we walk out on the street at night, I think you have to make the same decisions when you're putting yourself in circumstances with other people. When we walk out at night, we look around, we make sure we have our phone. Some people take mace. We take precautions. And all I'm saying is that women should take precautions.
Do you think it's possible for women to take all of those precautions and still be sexually assaulted, to still be pulled into a dark alley, to still
totally
be...
Totally different conversation.
To still...
Totally, being pulled into a dark alley is a totally different conversation.
So you are talking about sexual assault, women being sexually assaulted by somebody they know?
Correct.
Do you think it's possible for women to be sexually assaulted by somebody that they know, even if they've taken precautions?
Sure. Anything's possible, Megan. It's not about what's possible. It's about trying to, again, minimize the risk.
Again, that's Donna Rotunno, the lead attorney for Harvey Weinstein, speaking to Megan Toohey, investigative reporter for The Times. Megan DeChateauvieux, your reaction first. What did you think?
Speechless. There's so much in that statement. I'm actually very impressed with the reporter pushing those questions a little bit more. And I think that Donna's comments were actually a little more normal than I'd like to think. I think people...
More common.
More common. Would people do tend to think that if it hasn't happened to you, that's because you have kept yourself safe in some way that others are not able to. And that's not the case at all. So none of us want to walk into a situation or to have this happen to us. And yet it does in staggering numbers. And the idea that people that it hasn't happened to, I'm, you know, very glad that that hasn't happened to her. And I wish that were the case for more women and men. But we see this happening in such staggering numbers in our community and throughout the world that to make an assumption that it's somehow the fault of the victim because they weren't protecting themselves or carrying mace at the right time, when oftentimes it is someone that you know, as she's talking about, that's the perpetrator of these crimes. And so why would you carry mace on a fourth date with someone? Why would you think of yourself in these situations as having to protect yourself constantly? Why aren't we asking the question of how the perpetrators are able to get away with this? So also from the world that I'm coming from at Willow Domestic Violence Center, where marital rape is not uncommon, it's a tactic of abuse. We see the manipulation and power and control in that most intimate setting, in that most intimate of marriage or intimate relationship with someone where you live together and have for possibly decades. And that's still an occasion where sexual assault can happen. So do you carry mace into your bedroom? I mean, the absurdities of that argument she's making that we can somehow protect ourselves from this.
Well, and two things sort of come to mind for me. One is almost flippant. I think you're the attorney for Harvey Weinstein, and by implication what you're saying is, well, he might have assaulted those women, but did they have to go back to his office? They should have known better. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a very good job sort of offering your counselor skills there. However, to be more charitable, if she were here, she might be saying, no, no, no. All I'm saying is be realistic. We are in a world where this happens. Know that it happens and do everything you can to make sure you're not in a circumstance where it might happen to you. The end. No?
Well, and I think it's helpful to point out that we can have conversations all day long about risk reduction and they don't actually prevent any sexual violence. It's when we choose to actually talk about preventing violence before it happens, because a lot of those conversations not only pigeonhole sexual violence into a very narrow window, for which we know it happens much more widely than that in terms of gender or age or location or anything else. And one of the things that come to mind regarding whether or not people should carry mace and watch who they go out clubbing with is that we know as many as 1 in 10 children will be sexually assaulted before they turn 18. And so I don't know where they're supposed to put mace in their backpack on the way to kindergarten. So when we talk about the idea of prevention, it's not necessarily making sure that we're got our weapon ready and that we're making sure who we're surrounded by. Not only, like, those are certainly valuable tips for just general safety, but they're not stopping anyone from assaulting anyone. They're just making sure it's not you. And so when we talk about prevention, we're actually talking about changing the idea of attitudes and the idea that it's not okay to touch someone's body without consent, whether they're a man or a woman or don't identify as a man or a woman. And really beyond this understanding of this is something that happens when people of a certain gender do certain behaviors and make certain choices, which is not only unfair, but really belies the misunderstanding of sexual violence in and of itself, who it happens to and why it happens, which is about power and control. It's not about alcohol. It's not about lust. And it's not about people's inability to control themselves.
Before I get to your phone calls and your emails, just one other follow-up point here. We know that in this society, it's important that we have strong defense options for everyone. That does include for people like Harvey Weinstein, and it should include everybody in society. You have a right to counsel. You have a right to an attorney doing their best for you. Having said that, do you feel like when Donna Rotunno makes this statement she's made, she's gone too far? She's injured the public conversation understanding of this, or is she just doing her job? Lauren?
Well, as a defense attorney, I'm sure, you know, you have a specific agenda for which, you know, you're being paid and that you believe in. And so, you know, and to some degree, you can't fault someone for doing what they believe in, et cetera, sure, and so forth. But there really is a disservice when we're having a finally moment to really come to a consensus on what this issue really means and how it really does impact people. And when we surface only to kind of yank that conversation back to where it was decades ago, rooted in fundamental misunderstanding, which is that there's a certain set of behaviors you can do that will make yourself sexual violence proof. We know that's not true. We know that's not going to help anyone. And we also know that the only thing that conversation does is tell people that if they were assaulted, there was something they did to deserve it. And if it didn't exist inside the window of the person assaulting them being a stranger and a monster, then they weren't necessarily assaulted. And so really all that did was shroud this conversation in mystery and silence, and people didn't know what was going on or what happened to them or how to define what they were going through and how much pain they were in, or where to turn to for help. And so in many ways, it is a huge detriment to this conversation, and it really muddies the waters for people who genuinely are trying to understand.
Megan?
I think it's also an opportunity for learning. So I think that if we don't allow room for that kind of thought to bubble up to the surface, that we will not be able to engage with it or to address it in these ways. So we wouldn't be having this conversation today, for example, on this topic right now, about that victim blaming, about people who still hold those beliefs, and to say, like, we understand where those beliefs might be coming from, yet for all these reasons we've said, that's not accurate anymore. And I think people do hold those beliefs and kind of keep quiet about them if they know that it's not PC or whatever, so that we're able to really open up the dialogue a bit more and engage views that might be very different from our own and try to dispel the myths. So as much as these sort of myths come forward, I think it can be a learning opportunity in the conversation.
After our only break of the hour, your phone calls and emails, and we have a number to work through. You're hearing Megan DeChateauvieux, CEO of Willow Domestic Violence Center, and Lauren Berger, a training coordinator for Restore Sexual Assault Services. We're talking about the impact of the Weinstein verdict, the trial, the convictions on two felony counts, and the impact of the public understanding and a changing culture in this era of Me Too that really began with the publication of allegations against Harvey Weinstein in October of 2017. Your feedback is next. Coming up in our second hour, researchers have found radio waves coming from deep space. I say deep space. I'm not a technically trained expert. What I mean is 500 million light years away, radio waves coming at intervals, not a one-time event. What's created these radio waves? What do we know about that? What does it tell us about who could be out there? That's next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Jane in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes. I've noticed something, and I may be completely wrong about this, so I would like the panel to react to what I say, give me their opinion. But I've noticed when males have been raped, whether it's a coach or a priest or whoever it might be, there seems to follow a hushed silence afterward. No one that I've ever heard discussing male rape has launched into, well, what was he wearing? And why did he go with this other man to such and such a place? And so what I'm saying is sometimes they launch immediately into doubting the victim when it's female, but I don't hear quite that much when the victim is male. And I think that points to the extreme misogyny of the crime. So they tend to react in a blaming mode. It seems much more fiercely when the victim is female. And as to, you wouldn't put yourself in that position. You mean you would manipulate things so you're not alone with your stepfather? You were never alone with your boss. You were never alone with the minister or so forth. We had the example of Roy Moore trying to attack a 14-year-old who fought him off, which is very impressive to me. What I'm trying to say is she definitely didn't want to be raped or ask for it, and she was successful with that. But do you find a difference in terms of the doubting of the victim more so in the female case as opposed to when males are raped? Thank you very much.
All right, Jane, thanks very much. Thoughts? Lauren?
Jane, I just want to say thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts and your insight, and to say that you're absolutely right. In many ways, there really is a difference for how the conversation goes and how the understanding is shared when survivors identify as female versus when they identify as male. And I think the biggest difference is not so much that there isn't doubt and blaming, but just the genesis of where it comes from. We're much more reluctant to talk about sexual violence when males are impacted, and we don't much hear about it often. There's usually some huge exposure of a really epidemic case, and then it's sort of silenced, and we don't necessarily hear the outcome of it in ways that we've heard about Harvey Weinstein. And the doubt is more from that same gendered perspective of, you know, this idea of toxic masculinity that Megan was speaking about earlier, that idea of if you were the man, et cetera, and so forth, then being able to fight or being able to resist or being able to not bring on that kind of attention, much like the traditional victim-blaming attitudes. And it really is really detrimental to men and heartbreaking for them to not feel the validation and the space to seek that healing like they should be.
Okay. Megan Chateauvieux?
I've wondered about that, too, with the Me Too movement. Seems like it's primarily female-driven, women-led, and there are so many survivors coming forward who are women. And I haven't seen as many voices coming forward that are male and have experienced this. We, just on a local level, changed our name from Alternatives for Battered Women 5 years ago now to Willow Domestic Violence Center for that very reason, just to reflect that it's not just women who are the victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and to welcome all genders into our services and provide services for all. And I think the numbers that we have served of men have been growing steadily over those years, with something as, you know, significant as a name change to be more welcoming. And I also wonder if more men are feeling empowered to come forward and share their stories because of the strength of women. But I do see the difference in how they are treated, particularly with the media and the stories that we hear and the reactions to those stories coming out. I also wonder if it's because a lot of the stories about men, they're about boys, about youth, about the Boy Scouts and the church and the coaches, as you said, Jane. The situation is slightly different when we start talking about adults. There's a lot more agency involved, and people tend to be more judgmental. I'm reflecting too on our campaign for our new home at Willow Center. We also opened up a pet shelter, and we raised the funds for the pets nearly immediately. It took us a longer time to raise funds for humans because I think people look at pets and at children as sort of innocent victims, and they feel, you know, more support toward them and less blame.
Says something, and that's a powerful story. I mean, I remember hearing a story of a sheriff's car that was in an accident with a canine unit, and the vast majority of questions were about the health of the dog. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that sort of line up with the experience there, but a powerful point. Let me read some more feedback, and we'll get some more phone calls in a moment. Philip says, your guests, Evan, have made it clear it is not okay to have sex with someone who doesn't say yes. What about those who say yes, hoping for a job or a marriage or whatever, but years later regret it and charge unwanted sex? There's plenty of regretted sex. From Philip.
I think Philip, you know, has his experiences and can certainly, you know, speak his truth for himself, and I appreciate that. And I think there is a space for a conversation about sexual contact that we regret or feel some type of way about, for lack of better terms. And I think there's a place for that conversation within this larger conversation about what I usually end up talking about with high school programs when we talk about consent, is we end up getting to a space where we really have the need to be better and more articulate about the type of sex we want to have, which in many ways people are woefully unprepared to do just because of their relationship with themselves, sex education, lack of, you know, all those different variables. There is definitely lived experiences of people who come away from a sexual experience not feeling as though they were violated, but feeling as though there were certain needs that went unmet. And there really is a conversation to have between partners about those experiences.
But is that a crime?
As defined by the state of New York, to my knowledge, I'm not sure. I don't believe so. And we certainly know that depending on the context of what happened, if there's like a professional relationship, mm-hmm. where somebody has, you know, some sort of power role over that person, or say they're a landlord, then it's certainly possible, you know, depending on all those different variables and circumstances. But as far as we know, the way that the law defines consent right now is that there has to be that contemporaneous lack of willingness to participate, or that, again, that exchange of sort of what we say, like a quid pro quo type of situation. But I believe the conversation that Philip is talking about is one in which two partners can come together on an individual level and really discuss kind of maybe what went wrong and what they wanted out of that exchange. And really, honestly, I think there's a positive end to that conversation if people wished it to have it, to actually bring people closer together.
Well, in some ways, it's about just communicating better, right?
Right.
I don't know many adults who don't have at least one experience sexually that they kind of wish they hadn't had, or sort of regret in some way. And Philip, I appreciate the email. But I think the spectrum's really wide. I mean, if you look back and say, I regret having sex with this person because I realize now it was a supervisor at work who said, you want to keep your job, don't you? And I look back years later and said, boy, I convinced myself that I wanted that, but I was worried about getting fired. That's different kind of than saying, boy, you know, I was in college and we really moved too fast and, you know, I wish I hadn't done it. I mean, that to me is a very different spectrum of regret. Is that fair?
Well, I think that there's a way to be maybe more honest with ourselves and articulate with that as we all evolve in our understanding of what power and control means in terms of that lens over a sexual relationship and that sexual contact and what consent really means in that way, as opposed to begrudging willingness, as some might describe it. And as we come forward, people are going to define what happened to them in different ways, and they'll define what they see as justice in different ways. Someone who feels that their boundaries were not necessarily violated, but just that they had maybe certain needs in that exchange that were not met, might benefit from a conversation. Whereas someone who comes away from a years-long exchange of sexual favors, let's say, in exchange for career advancement or to keep their job,
right,
may really come away from that feeling, you know, this really was detrimental to my health. I really am violated. This really impacted my life. And I believe this broke the law.
And I'll ask you, and I'll ask you and Megan to both kind of weigh in on this. I think Philip's concern is reflected a little bit with what Donna Rotunno said after the Weinstein verdict, which is reflected in some of the concern about Me Too going too far, to the extent that there are some worried about that. And it sounds something like this. We are teaching kids and young adults that if you wake up the next morning after a sexual experience and wish you hadn't done it, you've been assaulted. Do you agree with that?
I think that's not really fair. I think, again, it's an opportunity to have a conversation. And when we say regret, what does that really mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, does that mean, you know, if I had a choice, if I had to choose again, I probably wouldn't this time, but it is what it is. Or is this, I really am shook, and I really don't know what to think about myself, and I really am experiencing physical and emotional shock and symptoms of trauma and feeling as though I was extremely violated and that there is something that I need to do about this. And those two feelings are very different things. And certainly being honest about that, being hopefully open and honest with the person that we're having the sexual contact with is certainly hopefully happening and it's in a healthy way. But that I think this conversation is constantly evolving. And so every time this comes up, rather than struggle over what Me Too might mean or that everything has to be truncated into either this box or that box, to instead welcome the chance to think about what this means for us and how are we going to apply this new understanding of communication and consent and regret and all these other variables into our own sexual experiences and talk about them with the people we love.
Megan, what do you think?
That's beautiful. And there's so many nuances to so much of this. And I keep reflecting about the Weinstein trial itself and thinking that oftentimes we get into a he said, she said situation or a she said, they said, all genders represented. But there's that one versus one kind of account of what happened the night before. And do we regret it? Was it assault? In this case, it was he said, she said, she said, she said, she said to 90 women coming forward, 96. So the matter of scale that came into this situation. And I'm curious about how many voices it took to finally have someone listen, the justice system respond in this way. And if we take this down to the one versus one scale of the very local, very intimate relationships that we're seeing in the work that we do at Restore and at Willow, I'm curious about how that will play out in the justice system as well.
Let me read a message from a listener. I'm not sure. I'm going to withhold the name just on my judgment based on reading this. But let me go ahead and read her message. Yes, openly, socially, our culture is starting to show support for women victims. But how do we bring about change behind closed doors? Women who are harassed and assaulted, who don't have an open avenue to big media. Lauren?
And that's where this decision about culture shift and application in our own lives really comes into play. It's about that choice of how are we going to apply this new understanding? What values are we going to prioritize? Who are we going to protect and what are we going to stand for almost? It sounds very kind of touchy-feely and nebulous, but really each individual organization, family, church, et cetera, has to make these choices where their leadership is to say, you know, where are we going to have these conversations and how is this going to be understood? Because just ignoring it and waiting for it to kind of blow over is not really an option at this point. And we already know that this understanding permeates so many different areas of our lives, that these conversations are so necessary to have in the ways that they're going to suss themselves out in each of those spaces.
In terms of what happens behind closed doors, I mean, that that happens all the time in our community. And I think people might be afraid to come forward or might have been afraid to come forward because of the system that they felt might fail them. And this shift in the criminal justice system that we're seeing right now with this case, I think will empower people to come forward. As always, people are welcome to call our hotline, 222-SAFE. It's 222-7233. And for sexual assault, the Restore hotline
is 585-546-2777 or online at restoresas.org.
Yeah, and there are great resources online, too, if people just want to kind of figure out what's going on and what resources they have out there. The National Domestic Violence Hotline has a fantastic website. We have our local Willow website and the Restore website. And I think just knowing that there are services and supports out there, we offer safety planning to anyone who is in an abusive relationship, and we can talk about what's happening behind closed doors and give people tools and skills and techniques to try to cope with that and then to find their way out if that's their direction they're taking, or to stay and make it work if it's not severe.
On Twitter, a couple of listeners are keying in on our guest comments about education, what we're teaching kids, what we're teaching young boys, but all kids at what levels, and referencing a kind of a community debate and a bit of a controversy today. And I want to give our guests a chance to weigh in if they like on a piece of legislation to the extent that they're comfortable talking about this, because our listeners are asking about a story from City Newspaper and our reporting of WXXI's James Brown about a bill A6512 in the New York State Legislature. It would require the state commissioners of education and health to develop standards for age-appropriate, medically accurate, and inclusive sex education to be adopted by school districts starting in kindergarten. I think a lot of people hear sex ed in kindergarten and think, why are you teaching kindergartners about sex? Everything I understand about this, talking to doctors, medical experts, and observing how this works in other countries where this is much more common, they're not teaching sex to five-year-olds. They're teaching healthy boundaries, healthy relationship building, understanding basic consent, and we're not even necessarily sexual consent, but, you know, kids are kids. They like to kind of poke each other, touch each other. But if a kid says stop, you stop. You respect people's bodies, their autonomy, their ability to say no, and you build a foundation for what a healthy interpersonal relationship looks like starting at a young age. So that's the bill. It has a lot of medical support in the medical community, as I understand it. I've heard from a lot of doctors today. But as City Newspaper and James Brown from WXXI report today, the mayor of Rochester is taking a stand against it. In fact, she sent a letter to state lawmakers and the governors and said that she thinks it's not appropriate and it's not okay to be teaching kids, to require school districts to teach this to kids in kindergarten. And a city hall spokesman, Justin Roy, said her opposition to sex education for kindergartners aligns with her longstanding religious beliefs, end quote. So there's a bit of a debate about that. And to the extent if you want to weigh in, what do you make of that? Megan Deschateau?
Sure. I think that children in kindergarten are learning about it anyway, whether we like it or not or know about it or not. They're hearing about it from older kids on the bus. They're hearing about it from siblings. They are learning from television, from movies. I mean, they're getting a lot of information and trying to put that together in their heads based on what kind of context. And if we're not providing it at home and it's not being provided at school, then they're filling in those blanks for themselves. And I think it's an opportunity for us as a community, as a state, from the education commissioner's standpoint, to develop a curriculum that is age appropriate, that does reflect the issues of healthy relationships and consent and being a good friend. I mean, we're starting in kindergarten with the very basic foundational building blocks. It's not the sex ed that we see in fifth grade or later. It's very much a foundational understanding of what relationships are. And for children to have that at the school and to be able to talk about it with their friends and have that common shared language as well, I think is really important. They will grow and learn together, and that will be the community culture shift that we need. And I don't think kindergarten is too early to start. I think the key is that it's age appropriate.
All right, so a couple of points there. Do you think it's a mistake to call it sex ed in reference to the earlier ages because of the connotation that some parents may have with it?
Possibly. I would like to see a healthy relationships curriculum.
Okay.
That's a much more preferred term in our realm, because with Restore providing education, a lot of times there is that same kind of like, if someone says, you know, you're providing, you know, sexual assault, consent education, you know, to elementary students, and you hear like the pearl clutching, you can hear it. And really when there's a chance to have that nuanced conversation about the programs that we do provide, actually one of our favorite ones has been for pre-K through third grade. It's evidence-based. It's one session with four puppets, and they teach four safety tools. And they're trust your feelings, try to say no, try to walk away, and tell an adult. And they're very basic safety tools that in many ways are done for to keep yourself safe from crossing the street, from not touching things that are hot, and implementing body autonomy and consent into those very basic building blocks is often much more palatable for folks. And really, that's all they're doing. It's just the chance to explore what it means when people say sex ed in kindergarten.
Okay, but a couple of things there, though. It sounds to me, based on the letter that the mayor sent, that she would say, all what you're talking about, fine. It should be up to the parents. Should not be done in schools. What would you say to that?
Well, I think having the common language, as Megan mentioned, is very, very important. And a lot of times when kids are at home, they might be using specific terms for body parts that are not medically accurate. And that can create a lot of confusion for somebody who's in a home where there is abuse, and can make it really difficult for that child to tell someone what's happening to them, or for that person to respond appropriately. And so ideally, they're getting these healthy and positive messages at home and at school, and able to synthesize this conversation in many areas of their life.
Megan, looking at City Newspaper and WXXI's feeds, I could read comments all day from parents saying, the mayor's right. That should be up to the parent and the parent alone and not the school.
I think we have a responsibility as a community to raise the next generation in a way that they understand what healthy relationships look like. And I'm not convinced that that's happening in every household. In fact, we know that many of the households themselves are abusive, that children are in these homes that are not safe for them. Their parents are involved in domestic violence. There's abuse and neglect. Our ACEs, the Adverse Childhood Experience Survey, the scores are incredibly high in this community. We have so many children who are suffering. And so that's a wonderful idea that we teach this at home, that we share with our children what we want them to grow up with, that we instill these values, that we are very open. But that's not what's happening in a lot of households. And so to standardize it and have this baseline that all children are exposed to, and to be able to have that safety in the schools, where that's a safe place to talk about these things too with their school counselors or their teachers, I think that's only a benefit to our entire community.
Were you surprised by the mayor's letter?
Yes. Yes, I was. I'm not sure. I think the framing might be the issue. I think your point to saying sex ed at young ages might be part of that she's coming out against it, because it seems like something that we could all stand behind. And
healthy relationship education.
Yes. I mean, it's a basic foundational skill, and we're teaching children so many things, but we're not teaching them how to be, you know, a good person. And if that's not happening in the school system and it's not happening at home, where are they going to get it?
Would you meet with the mayor if she says, hey, all right, let's talk about it. Like, if there's a misunderstanding, let's talk about this.
Absolutely. Always.
I'm always happy to have conversations about these issues, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll be following Bill A6512. And again, New York is one of 21 states that do not require schools to teach sex education, including the topics of birth control or STD prevention, but really at any age. And so it'd be different. And so before we wrap the program, we're connecting this to the way we understand relationships at all parts of our life. If we don't have that foundation young for kids, what's your concern? What happens?
Well, we know that tweens are experiencing relationship violence and dating violence at staggering levels. 1 in 5 tweens have had physical dating violence, and the manipulation and power and control that happens, especially with technology, it's rampant. And we're talking about 10-year-olds. I mean, this is happening in 4th grade, 5th grade, and the relationships that they're setting up and the expectations at that age will last a lifetime. So if we don't do more to address what's happening at a younger age, then we will set up this culture shift, this Me Too movement will be for nothing.
And Lauren?
We're such awash in the saturation of all these stories and all this suffering all around us. And if we don't use this as an opportunity to reset what we think is normal and to create a healthier expectation for our future, both at an individual level and about our friends and in community, then like Megan said, you know, it will have all have been for nothing. And we really will have missed that opportunity. And if we grew up in an environment where these values are kind of just circling around left of their own devices, we really risk creating another generation of folks who think it's okay, depending on who someone is, you know, to cause interpersonal violence with impunity and for others to have to suffer in silence.
As we close our last 90 seconds here, Harvey Weinstein likely headed to prison for up to 29 years. What's next? What's the next sign that the culture really is changing in a way that you think is appropriate, Lauren?
I think it'll really be marked by, in the coming weeks, months, if there are more movement in some of the various avenues that people have. Like I said, it might be through criminal justice for some people. There might be actual laws to be changed or different legal options to be open to folks for like civil damages or other types of things that might be up for litigation. And it might also be other types of avenues of change, like a return to values of body autonomy and consent in types of education at younger and younger ages, or more of a culture of accountability in individual workspaces or churches or social clubs or wherever the people might be gathering. If there really are more attention paid and conversations had about what it really means when somebody makes that joke or shared that post on social media, and what does that really mean, and what are we really doing in this workplace, in this place of worship or what have you, and really that will be one of the things that I'd be most looking forward to seeing.
Mm-hmm. Megan Ashantavia?
And I'd like to see a huge spike in the numbers reporting. And I want people to come out and share what's happening to them and see those numbers go way up. And then I want to see them completely disappear, because I think that we have an opportunity to air that and to receive justice for the people who have experienced this, and then to get ahead of it and to fully prevent domestic violence and sexual assault from happening in the first place. So I'd like to see us both out of business.
The number, it's a profound comment to make, the number to call Willow is what?
It's 585-222-SAFE. That's 222-7233.
Online where?
WillowCenterNY.org.
Lauren?
And Restore's Monroe County 24-hour hotline is area code 585-546-2777 or online at RestoreSAS.org.
RestoreSAS, SexualAssaultServices.org. Thank you, Lauren. Thanks for being here and sharing your expertise.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Ashantavia, thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
More Connections coming up.